welcome to episode number 86 of The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Leopold Stokowski, and I'm joined today by two very distinguished gentlemen who go by the name of Michael Pick and Tim Murtaugh, or Monkey Do, a web design and development studio in New York City. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And before we begin, we've got to thank our sponsor. Our sponsor today is Shutterstock.com, where you'll find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. Start your search at Shutterstock.com to find that perfect image for your website, ad, publication, or any other creative project. Shutterstock gives you a global image collection to find images from around the world to suit your project. Choose between image packs and monthly subscription packages. Choose whatever fits your need and never have to compromise. If you need just one big image for your blog or mock-up, you can do that too. Every time you visit, you'll find something new since they add 10,000 new images every day. That's terrifying, actually, isn't it? 10,000 new images every day. That's like Google or something. That's huge. That's immense. That's really great. They have light boxes that you can curate, and you can use their iPad app to do this. They have enhanced license access. If you like an image and want to run it in print or swag for your trade shows, they can get an enhanced license for any image. And they got 24-hour support during the week, which is very impressive. So sign up for a free account. Go to Shutterstock.com. No credit card needed. I like that part because that sounds really awesome to not have to use a credit card. Sign up for a free account. Go to Shutterstock.com where you find the images you like and decide to purchase. Use offer code BigWebShow3 to get 30% off any package. That's BigWebShow3 to get 30% off at Shutterstock.com. Thank you to Shutterstock. And now, with no further ado, my guest today, Monkey Do builds websites that bring you to your users. And they have worked on some pretty impressive sites, such as the World Science Festival, EconoMonitor, Scientific American, An Event Apart, and the recent A List Apart redesign. So, Mike and Tim, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Jeffrey.
You also have projects, right? You did the HTML5 reset. You've got a project called Got a Few Minutes. What's that about?
Well, we have a number of small projects that we do in our spare time for a couple of reasons. One is it's always good to fill your spare time. But the main reason we like to do these smaller projects is because sometimes as we're approaching a larger project, there are questions about that larger project that we haven't quite answered yet. So sometimes we take the opportunity to use these smaller projects to answer those questions.
Like you design something on your own time, on your own dime, that with an eye toward using what you're going to learn in the client work you're going to build for.
Exactly. Like in the case of A List Apart, as we were approaching the technical development of A List Apart, I knew that social sign-on was going to play a factor. It didn't exist on the previous version of the site, but we knew we wanted it for the new site. So last fall, as we had some time, Mike and I built this little app called Got a Few Minutes. And it's really nothing more than a little app that takes in ideas and spits out random ideas for what you might do to fill your time. If you have an extra few minutes, I might recommend that you go clean your cupboards or water the plants or yada, yada, yada.
A quick dozen push-ups is what I'm getting right now, which is very nice.
Exactly. And so we built Social Sign-On into this little app as a way of proving the concept to ourselves so that we knew how to do it when the A List Apart build came around.
How hard was it?
It wasn't that hard, actually. Expression Engine makes it fairly easy to integrate those features.
And were you using Facebook's Open Graph and something from Twitter? What was the technological hurdles or the technological tools that you used to make it work?
Well, it was, it's not something that's hard to do. It's just something we hadn't done before. So we just wanted to prove to ourselves and go through the process and just make sure there weren't going to be any surprises when we wanted to go set it up for a list part for actual client work.
Did you have control over the user experience, or is it more like, here's this plugin for Expression Engine that takes care of it, and this is the user experience, we've already figured it out?
There is a plugin for Expression Engine that we use called Social Login that takes care of the Expression Engine side of it. You still have to do a little bit of tinkering in dealing with Facebook directly and dealing with Twitter directly to set up applications on those platforms and to make sure that form submissions are being redirected to the right place. And that can be a little bit hit or miss, but I think we worked it all out.
Mike.
Yes.
For the list apart redesign, what you went through a lot of iterations and thinking and changes. Take us through some of the process of addressing this majestic and well-loved site.
well-loved is now up in the air with the new logo and that sort of thing, and all that flim-flammery. But it was kind of a long process, and so that's a big question to answer. We started the process probably months ago, and I remember, we worked through at first the idea of simply updating the site so that it looked a little bit more modern. And as we carried on through different rounds of designs, that approach became less satisfactory. And so that's how I think we came to basically throwing out almost everything that we had decided we wanted to carry forward from the older designs and approach it with something that was fairly starkly new and completely different from the old pages.
But not Kevin Cornell's illustrations.
No, and in fact, that was one of the things that we really wanted to put a lot more focus on, because they are fantastic, and they're every week they're a little eye-opener and really delightful to receive. And so that was probably the biggest push, I guess, that we wanted to put forward in the visual design.
We are now serving Retina images to those who want them. Can we talk a little bit about what hoops are involved there and how you guys are approaching that?
Well, the first step was to revisit. Mike spent quite a bit of time revisiting all the original illustration files and cleaning them up.
To match the background, right?
Right. Well, mostly it was just a matter of deciding on a system for regularizing them. And luckily we had a full archive. It took some finding, but we found a giant folder full of every image that had ever been of Kevin's that had ever been put up on the site. And from there, it was just a matter of resizing them. Thankfully, he's always scanned them at high resolutions. And so there was a lot of good material to work with. And it was sort of an interesting process, because as I worked through the images, you could see a progression in his ability, I guess, to use, you know, the scanner, to use the tools. And so they would be cleaner and nicer and easier to work with as we counted down from image 200 to image, I guess it's probably 360 or 370.
And you cleaned up stray marks, things like that. And so now you've cleaned them up, and you've sort of regularized them in spite of the fact that there were irregularities, kind of archaeological irregularities in the creation.
Irregularities.
I just basically was like, you guys solved this, and you did. So how do you solve for responsive images?
Well, it's actually, we have the Filament group to thank for that. We're using their, one of their jQuery plugins to detect the capability of the browsers, of the user's device and browser, and then the JavaScript determines which, it's called the Picture Fill jQuery plugin. And what you do is you put in some placeholder markup in the templates, and in the placeholder markup, you include any number of different URLs to any number of variations of the illustrations. So we're actually including three URLs, one for retina displays, one for standard displays, and one for small displays. And when the page loads, the picture fill plugin scans the capability of the browser and determines which of those images to load.
How, Mike, are you manually producing five or six different versions of each image every week?
No, we just produce one large size, which at this point now, when we get images, we just run them through a couple of Photoshop action sets that crop them down to, you know, the kind of artboard area that he's working within, and cleans up the levels and that sort of thing. And then we run the open source image Optim program on it, which does manage to squash the size down somewhat of the 24-bit PNGs that we use. And then we upload those to the server, and that's where the magic happens.
So whenever we produce an issue or articles, Mike uploads his, you know, full size but optimized version of the file. And then when the HTML pages are request through Expression Engine, Expression Engine is using a plugin called CE Image, which actually creates every different variation of any image that we might need. So we deal with one image. The system can put out as many different variations of it as we want.
And how, talk about that, just the process of coming in sort of in the middle, right? Because a lot of IA work had been done and a lot of initial thinking had been done. Tim, you were part of the initial brainstorming 14 months ago, but Mike, you hadn't been. And then making it your own, rethinking basically every assumption that had been made so far. Any examples of that that are interesting?
That was a challenging process, I think, for me. Mentally, because obviously it's sort of it's a you know, to use the cliche, it's standing on the shoulders of giants. So I'm taking work from taking the IA and taking Jason Santa Maria's designs and trying to take the parts from that that I want to use while trying to make the design my own. The initial IA. The initial thinking done on it was very ambitious and expansive, and a sort of an interesting part of the process of getting to designing the site was trying to focus in on the parts that we wanted to really focus in and tighten the scope somewhat from how it had grown when people were kind of, you know, blue skying it and coming up with a lot of different functionality and features.
Right, because we basically wireframed a five-year plan with features done, you know, managed by a staff of hundreds. And
that's not where we are now.
That's not where we are now. But, you know, hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah.
There was also, we had Sarah, our editor, working with us often long distance, but coming in sometimes from Bucks County, PA, mm-hmm. to brainstorm. Is there anything else you want to talk about in that design, or? Sorry, this is the worst question ever. I'm totally sorry.
It's very open-ended.
Here's the thing. I could talk about a list apart all day, but I don't think we want to do that.
It has been interesting, the reception. Most everybody, most responses are very positive. But as you would expect with a property or a brand that's been around for such a long time, you know, people have any change can cause, very polarized reactions sometimes. So it's been very interesting to watch, you know, people who love the new design, people who are ambivalent to the new design, people who hate the new design.
Well, I think a lot of people are comfortable with the big type, right? That ground has been broken. And I think people are getting that, you know, the types... nice and that the type is responsive, not just the layout. I think people right. are.
I'm sure there are people out there listening going, no.
Yeah. Well, we'll hear from them on Twitter
exactly.
very soon. The most controversial thing in my experience was the cropped logo, which it's right. a responsively cropped logo treatment.
which was surprising. I don't know, Mike, how you feel about it, but I was surprised that that was the most, I'm not sure controversial is the exact right word, but it was, people were very vocal about their dislike of the Crop logo.
Polarizing, I think, is the word, which is, and it was really kind of, I was actually, frankly, very surprised too. And I don't know if it's because we had been sitting with it for so long or if it just seemed like a natural thing for us to do within this little bubble that, you know, we had kind of developed as we were doing the designs. And so, yeah, it was surprising to see how many people responded strongly one way or the other. The big type question is also really interesting, I think, because I'm really growing to like, you know, large type on websites. And I don't know if it's for every website. It definitely has a tonal quality that it lends to the feeling that you get when you come to a site. There's just something so strange about using large type like this because of the way that websites have developed almost in opposition to the way, you know, the devices that we use to browse them on work. And so you struggle with kind of fitting large type in readable line lengths and columns in a widescreen device that's more suited to watching movies, at least on the desktop. So it's interesting, and I can see that's why I understand the complaints in some ways, because I feel like it's a square peg round hole kind of problem.
Well, responsive design makes it more interesting and more challenging because you kind of want to have big impactful type on every device, but at the same time, you obviously don't want to put like, you know, 6 characters on a person's phone and expect them to deal with that. I think that's what led you to playing with those ideas, as I remember, is kind of what led you to taking that logo and just starting to crop it responsively.
And right. Well, that was definitely the impetus behind that. We designed this logo for a desktop experience, and it's large and has a lot of impact. And simply shrinking it in a sort of liquid way meant that as it got smaller horizontally, it also got smaller vertically. So all of that impact kind of, you know, bled out of it the smaller that it got on the smaller screens. And that's what led to that idea of cropping it, you know, very tightly on the phone, for example, or somewhat tightly on the iPad. But I think it's interesting because it's almost about questioning what the function of a logo is on a website. In some ways, we've almost gotten to the point where we could define a logo element in markup and have it be sitting top left by default with a little bit of padding around it. It's the first thing that everybody does when they design a website, and you could probably browse websites and see that 98% of them do it that way. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to try and, you know, challenge that idea or pick apart that idea or just do something different from it. I mean, do people, when you don't have a product that's sitting on a shelf where somebody's walking down the potato chip aisle and they need to recognize your bag of potato chips, Elistapart is a different brand and a different product from that. Does the logo need to be as, you know, front and center and recognizable on every page as it might be in other contexts?
Also, you designed a mark, a very beautiful mark, but you mostly use it real small in like navigation. There's this sort of double reef, right? Originally, like 7 years ago, Jason Santamaria had designed this beautiful reef, and that went to all the apart brands, right? A list apart, event apart, book apart. And now, right, in the last couple of years, it's been, you know, you designed a new wreath for an event apart, you designed a new wreath for a list apart, but on a list apart, you didn't, whereas Jason's design, there was sort of this cigar wrapper and everything was really careful and delicate and the logo and the mark were, you know, part and parcel of each other. Here, you were sort of like, here's some type, and you didn't do anything to the type. I mean, you kerned it, but it's not like you, do you know what I mean? That also may have shocked some people, but I think you were going for the opposite. You were sort of like, okay, that's what we did, so let's do the opposite.
Right. No, it's not a traditional kind of mark and typography lockup I think. But I also think that that's a very interesting idea, the idea that you could develop branding elements, you know, and use them in different ways in sort of different locations around the site. I thought it was, there was a question that came up just after we launched this design, I think, where somebody had asked about the idea of visual branding and how we basically sort of, in their opinion, we'd thrown out a lot of the branding from the previous site and we don't use as much sort of branding, quote unquote, within the site. And I think sometimes maybe there's, maybe a little bit too much conflation of visual assets, logos and buttons and, you know, icons and that sort of thing. And this idea of branding, which strikes me as being more of a, you know,
but the branding isn't just the elements themselves. It's how you use the elements.
Right.
And it's other non-visual elements.
Right. Exactly. I mean, part of the brand is, for Aristopart, is the ideas that the site espouses, I think. I mean, that's probably the most important part of the brand.
Or the fact that there are these issues that are carefully edited and curated, not, you know, we have more of a fire hose now, but for a long time, this site like came out every 2 weeks and it was sort of like, here's this mini event. As opposed to Huffington Post, where like every 10 minutes, there's a new piece. Is a different approach to publishing, and that's part of the brand.
Right.
Yes, right. Another, it's interesting. The other idea around branding that I'd sort of come across recently was the idea that, I mean, once you dig into these articles, they're very, some might say stark, but, it's type and it's the illustrations that go along with the site. And so there's not a lot of what you would call branding once you actually get into reading the articles, in the visual sense. And, I'm not certain that that's a bad thing necessarily.
No, it feels like a book.
Right. Exactly. I mean, if you open a book to the middle page, like a paperback or something like that, there's not really much branding. There's just type on the page. And I think that's the effect that we were going for. And the issue, the idea of that concept of issues as branding that you were speaking about, I think that's one of the things that makes the site really interesting. And that is one of the things that made us want to hold on to this idea of reading and literature and, a bookish approach as opposed to more of a magazine or a weekly or maybe a splashier approach.
And it's weird. I think in both cases, in Jason Santa Maria's design, he was sort of looking at, they're both about reading. And the reading experience. Jason's was kind of looking at, you know, reconceiving what had been a very, very different brand as kind of a library or almost like Beaux-Arts, right? Like the New York Public Library, sort of fancy and scrollery and tracery, and it's very elegant, genteel and soft colors. And so you were saying, yeah, that's the brand, reading. So now let's flip that on its head and make it about like reading Esquire magazine or something like that. It's still a very, but an in your face, a more in your face reading experience for a world where we don't have tight control over the layout because we've got all these devices to fit the layout into.
That's interesting actually, because it has that, the site does have this sort of in your face quality with the large type and illustrations and the logo and that sort of thing. But then when you put it in that term, like the Esquire or magazine approach, it's actually almost directly the opposite because it's so stripped down, you know, to the essence. Mm-hmm. So the sort of, I guess that's what you'd call a dichotomy.
A dichotomy. Exactly. People, we had a guy complain, right, about Georgia. Very upset that you chose Georgia as the typeface because it should have been a modern web font. Remember this?
Right. I think he'd be happy then that we didn't end up using Verdana Pro as well.
Right. Our original plan was to use Georgia and Verdana and Blue Links, which mostly was what we ended up doing.
2 out of 3.
Yeah, 2 out of 3.
The Georgia's really interesting because of this update of Georgia, Georgia Pro that we use, does actually have a number of features that There's new glyphs, and I think the kerning and the hinting is better probably than the other version. And there's also the semi-bold weights and the condensed weights that we use. So there's a lot more to it than just using Georgia.
And there's condensed on phone views, right?
Right. This was an idea that actually Nick Sherman brought up with us. This idea of when we get down to the smallest, the narrowest views, that we use a condensed font and sort of take that idea, the idea of responsiveness, one step farther, where not only does the box that the type is contained in change size and, you know, the type sizes and that sort of thing, but the actual letter forms change as well to reflect the viewport that it's within.
It's Nick Sherman from WebType, the company that makes Georgia Pro and Verdana Pro. And we all share studio space, I should say that, because it sounds a little, it wasn't like a client vendor relationship in any of this, but it's like we're all just sort of working together in this studio space, space apart in New York. So
yeah,
And
I'll be honest and say that's that proximity led to a much better result than I think some of us expected. Like I'm in love with the new site, but I also think like the downside of that is it gives you too much time to discuss every little bit and piece. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think it's a tribute to you guys also did an event apart redesign. And I think it's a tribute to our social skills or our friendship or something that, I mean, imagine it was kind of like you had, I felt sometimes like a client and sometimes like a creative director, but I was always kind of in your way. I mean, there would be times where you would kind of go off and sneak off in a corner and start talking about something. And I go, they're talking about a list apart. I should be part of that conversation. No. Let them work. Let them work. Don't interfere. But I was like, you know, I mean, there was no privacy in, cause you guys are a very strong team, but you kind of lost that privacy to work on this.
Sure. But yeah. That was great in some ways. But it didn't lend itself to making decisions for some reason. Do you know what I mean? Because we would discuss the logo and we would test the logo and we would look at 50 iterations of how the logo could be positioned. And, you know, you would make one argument and I would make another argument and Mike would make another argument. And we came up with so many good ideas. It was hard to settle on one.
I was three designers, four opinions on everything.
And there's also not the same pressure, I think, in a sort of that you have in a traditional, you know, client relationship where timelines and that sort of thing matter a lot more. And also with your design background, that obviously helps, gives us a real shortcut in terms of talking about things or referring to things that we're doing.
That was also had positives and negatives because in a client vendor relationship, although we wouldn't have come up with what we did, it wouldn't have been as good. But in a client-vendor relationship, there would have been deadlines and dates. And, you know, Sarah kept saying, well, when's this going to happen? And Tim would say, well, it's going to happen pretty soon. But so I will tell you guys now that there was a week where I said, like, to myself, this has to happen now. And so basically I went into the gym that day and there's with my trainer. I said, like, kill me today. Just kill me. Because I wanted to feel like a boss. I wanted to feel very powerful and like I could exert willful control over you guys. And I just did all these push-ups and all this miserable stuff and hated being alive for about an hour. Felt like I was being tortured. And then after I was done and had washed up, I was just like, I can do anything now. I could do anything now. And I walked in and went, I like clapped my hands and went, all right, let's go. You guys went like, oh, he's just not being kind of that nice pushover that he usually is. That's sort of, but like, okay, Jesus, Zeldman really wants us to do something now. Okay, this has to get, and I was like, I just kept looking around like, shall I get some lunch? I was just like totally being a jerk, but I had the ability, which I rarely possess, to just you know, be Svengali-ish and just make it happen, I thought.
It all came together very quickly.
Yeah.
A little too quickly in some respects, but as you say, it had to get out the door.
It's weird because, yeah, we kind of agonized over it for 14 months, deliberated over every detail, and then, like, banged it out in 2 weeks.
Right. And yeah, we launched somewhat unexpectedly, and there were things we forgot. Like, I completely forgot to turn on the caching engine, so the site struggled for a couple hours while 100,000 people were trying to visit it. But it all settled out, and it all turned out very well, I think.
You did a really beautiful job reimagining an event apart, too, I think. And we'll move on to other projects in a minute, but I want to really give you props for that, because when what we had designed for an event apart was a nice little event site that sold tickets, and what you turned it into is a content site where people can actually come watch videos, read articles, and that, you know.
Yeah. Well, Mike hasn't had the opportunity to go to an event, to one of the conferences yet, but I have. I went to the one in Boston, not last year, I think the year before. And the care that you guys put into that show is just astounding. And I don't remember talking to anybody who wasn't having not just having a great, you know, business experience or learning experience, but just the quality of the experience was so satisfying. You were so glad to be there. And all the speakers are fantastic. And, you know, that business has been growing for a couple of years, and it makes sense that that website needed to be a little bit bigger, a little bit more holistic, and not just about the tickets, but also about the speakers and, you know, what goes on in between the events.
Well, thank you. And that was another project that worked really comfortably with the three of us just sort of in different roles, just sort of casually evolving. It was tricky because I have a partner, Eric Meyer, who is a brilliant guy who isn't here. He's in Ohio. So there was that. And we have really committed staff members who also wanted to be part of every decision. And they couldn't be because.
Right. Well, and that's the big lesson that I think Mike and I took away from that project is, even though we had one of the primary stakeholders in the room with us, we didn't take as many opportunities to reach out to everybody who had a stake in the project. So the three of us in a room made decisions that, you know, even though the other stakeholders may have agreed with those decisions, we didn't include them on the discussion and the thought as much as we have. And that was, I think, the thing I'm most disappointed about that project. And the project turned out great. I'm totally happy about it. But if I could do one thing differently to make it a better process, it would be to not lean so much on, you know, the relationship in the room, but to kind of formalize a process to bring in all the stakeholders.
Well, I'm glad to hear you sounded guilty in taking the blame, because I feel like it's completely my fault, not yours at all. And it's really up to me to say, you know what, I like this, but I should talk to my partner and we should talk to the staff. And instead I kept going, yeah, do that. That's cool. Like,
right. It's not a matter of blame on anybody's part. I don't think it's just a matter of, Mike and I work organically a lot of the time. We don't have very many formal processes. So as we go through projects, at the end of a project, a lot of times it's really easy to say, oh, okay, well, next time, we'll do this better. Because like I say, in the room, it's very easy to be organic and have a discussion and make design or technology decisions. But you also have to, in this case, it would have been better to have talked to a larger circle.
See, that organic process is something I love about the way you guys work. And it's something that I miss now. And it's one reason I reached out to you guys for these projects, because HappyCog does these wonderful jobs, big jobs. And we, of course, have to have a lot of processes in place, because we're, you know, it's like this giant museum or this giant university with, you know, thousands of pages and all that stuff. So there has to be a lot of planning and thinking, and you don't have that luxury. And I miss that, because I started out doing much smaller jobs and being very organic about, you know, how everything happened. And so for me, it's been this wonderful return to the roots of, you know, how I initially learned.
Right. Well, there are definitely lots of benefits, lots of upsides, plenty of downsides for me as the technologist, the primary technologist on the projects that Mike and I work on, for me, one of the major benefits of the way we work is it makes responsive design development, the development of a responsive design, kind of counterintuitively easier, because when Mike is working on designs, we never consider them final until they're in HTML. So the designs are, and Mike has completely up-to-date experience with HTML5 and CSS. So not only does he know how to design something that can be built, he and I know how to work together to make responsive decisions after what you might call, the primary design has been decided upon. I think people would argue with us that in the way that we treat the kind of full-size desktop design, the primary design, a lot of people like to think mobile first. But I think our process works very well.
Yeah, I agree. Tell me about some of your other projects. Like when we first started sharing a studio space, you guys had an app called Edible City. That was, what was that about? What just happened?
Sorry, I thought I was maybe on mute.
No.
No, we got you.
Okay, we got you.
Okay, good, good. That was, like many people around that time a few years ago, we were experimenting with the idea of food truck tracking and managing that kind of stuff. I guess I don't have to explain the food truck phenomenon to anyone at this point because it's pretty well established and documented. But
the weather just turned nice in New York, and as I was biking up Third Avenue, I was literally surrounded by food trucks this morning heading uptown.
So that was an interesting self-directed project, which kind of involved a lot of responsive design thinking, although not perhaps in the kind of established sense. And also a lot of Google mapping integration and some really interesting kind of technology. And so we had been running that for a little while, but it was hard to find a way to kind of make it, what's the word I'm looking for?
Pay for itself.
And also to, and also maintain all the immense amounts of data that needed to be gathered for it pretty much on a daily basis.
It still exists. I can still go to ediblecity.com.
Right. Right. It does still exist. It's a tech demo at this point. So I wouldn't go looking for lunch at any of those trucks.
Okay. So that's too bad because I see that there's a traveling waffles and dings.
Oh, the waffle and dingus truck is one of the more popular trucks around the city.
Dingus? Is that what it's called?
It's a Dutch word. It means things you put on waffles.
I think Belgian, actually.
Yeah.
Belgian, yes.
Okay.
That was a really fun project from the technology side. And
the icons are great. You designed those?
Yes.
Those little food trucks, they're like, it reminds me of Icon Factory's work. It's just really beautiful. You do that in Illustrator?
That's right.
And little burgers and waffles and stuff, how do you...
Yeah, Mike is actually a very good illustrator, and we don't get to stretch that muscle very often. We're working with a client right now who's building a browser plugin, and he's been able to do some amazing sketches for them. But that's kind of a secret hidden talent of Mike's.
Yeah, you did the was it What Lies Beneath? Was that the name of the?
I think that was maybe that was one of the. Zen Garden designs
originally. Did a CSS Zen Garden design in like 2002 that I put in the first edition of Designing with Web Standards because to me it was the most awesome. One of the most awesome. To me it was the most awesome. I'll just be honest. To me that was the most awesome thing I saw because it completely reimagined. A lot of the other things were beautiful, but they were still sort of pages. And this was just like, I should go back. This is the Dave Shea's CSS Zen Garden. Everybody listening remembers that. That was the site that made designers go, oh, CSS is cool. That was the first time I think a lot of designers went, oh, and oh, CSS abstracts document, you know, the words from the pictures. I never knew that.
This is actually really interesting because for whatever reason, a couple of weeks ago, people were tweeting and retweeting comments where people were making about their disappointment in responsive design and how all the responsive design sites look the same and, you know, this isn't terribly interesting and yada, yada, yada. But I think with responsive design, we are now at exactly the same point that CSS was when the Zen Garden was introduced, in that we now have this new technology that we're learning how to make use of, and we're right on the cusp of people actually doing really interesting things with it.
Although I think some people have done really interesting things with it already, but yeah, I take your point. And I only brought up CSS Zen Garden because that's the first time I saw Mike's work, and it was the illustration work. He had like blind moles under the ground and just crazy drawings of all kinds of stuff. And this was a CSS layout.
Yeah, it was interesting. I think maybe took the whole thing and turned it on its side was sort of the initial concept behind it. And I don't know how I came up with that idea, but it came together really quickly. I can't even remember, to be honest with you, how I came across the Zen Garden site. I don't know if it might've been from your site at the time, Jeffrey, or maybe from Cuban Council or another one of the sites that was sort of big at the time. I guess that's 10 years ago now, which is seems like a really long time. And it's sort of charming to look at those initial designs and think about, you know, image replacement and all these other sort of techniques that we used then that have now sort of ended up on the graveyard of CSS.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true.
And it's because now, I mean, I think with the sort of latest HTML5 and responsive designs and that sort of thing, there is a much more of a sense of purity about the separation between the content and the layout than we could achieve back then.
Very true also. I'm constantly feeling shame in like my old fashioned knowledge of CSS. I remember during one of the discussions that we were having about List Apart or In a Better Part, I said, well, you'll have to put that image in the background because otherwise you'll have scroll bars. And Tim was just laughing at me like, so we don't have to do that anymore. Tim, do you guys want to talk about the impetus behind HTML5 reset?
Right. That was something that I did a couple of years ago. I can't remember, at least 2 years ago at this point. It's kind of a long suffering project in that I neglected for long periods of time. It was right about when HTML5 was really first being adopted by everybody. And I think like everybody, I had kind of a stock set of templates that I start every project with. And I figured, you know, HTML5 is new. People might not have their own HTML5 stock set of templates. So I'll just release it to everybody. And it preceded the HTML5 boilerplate by about a week, which has become immensely popular because it's fantastic. But I still like, I prefer to start with the HTML5 reset files because they're simpler and they start from a more basic standpoint. And the reset styles actually reset all styles, where the HTML5 boilerplate has taken the approach of normalizing the styles. And I prefer the reset approach.
Right. Set everything to zero and then let the designer decide, as opposed to, have the same line height, or let's have all browsers make the same assumptions about your code.
The normalization approach is great, but I still prefer to not have to overcome the normalized styles as I'm applying a design to HTML.
Well, the folks behind HTML boilerplate work for browser companies, right?
They do.
It makes sense that they would take the normalization approach.
And it is fantastic. Like I do incorporate any number of elements from the boilerplate in the reset, and even in my own, you know, extended version of the reset. But I'm glad that you mentioned the reset files, because I did actually finally get around to updating them the other day. So if anybody's interested, they can go take a look at GitHub. I'm on GitHub at github.com/murtaugh, which is M-U-R-T-A-U-G-H. And there you can find the HTML5 reset. And there's a companion repo in GitHub for the WordPress HTML5 reset files, which are even more long neglected because I don't work with WordPress very often. Fortunately, a buddy of mine on Twitter, CK Hicks, is a WordPress developer, and he has picked up the development on that. So anybody who's interested in that, keep an eye out, because CK Hicks will be making some upgrades to the WordPress reset files.
Are you adding Twitter cards and Facebook OG to the...
I did, actually. There are Open Graph meta tags and Twitter meta tags and lots of good stuff.
Very cool. And that's at
html5reset.org.
I should point out, so that's html5reset.org. Is there a .com? I'm just curious.
I think it was taken by somebody else.
And what did they do with it? We don't know.
I don't actually know.
And you're at monkeydo.biz.
It forwards to an agency in Philadelphia, actually. And okay. They have a very nice looking website.
Okay, that was smart of them. You also, MonkeyDo, your development and design studio, is at monkeydo.biz.
It is.
Who's at .com?
I don't know. We picked up the .biz domain up a couple of years ago. We knew we wanted the name MonkeyDo, and we didn't really care what the domain was. Somebody at the time had the .com. But it looks like in the meantime, some marketing agency, it looks like in Florida, has picked up the .com.
I have a feeling our site, our .biz site, is older than the .com site. I can't remember when we first noticed that. That one came into being.
It is. I think we missed an opportunity at one point to pick up the .com.
Oh, yeah, that could be.
Do you do your site is nicely responsive too. You do Christmas cards or just funky little projects like that just for...
We did that one year, and it took a shocking amount of work, as it turned out, at the end. So we just didn't get around to doing it this past year, I think, because we were in the throes of... A list apart and event apart as well, unfortunately. So it's one of those things that's, again, it's just a fun project to kind of take on, you know, when you have some time.
Oh, dear. Actually, you have a fatter, older me.
One of my favorite things on our site is the screencast of Jeffrey Zeldman trying to sign a contract the modern way.
That's just sad.
It was hilarious.
Yeah, I wasn't even playing it up. I wasn't like acting hapless. I just really felt hapless.
No, it was the lovely Adobe experience that we all enjoy so much.
Well, yeah. So you have a secret project coming up you guys are working on? A product?
Well, we have a couple of projects that we can't talk about because the clients are still in development on their own side. We've provided design and we've provided some technology to them, but they're still working on actually two projects that we've done that we did IA design and front-end work for that they now have kind of back-end teams building applications for them. We like to work with Expression Engine and we love to build publishing systems, but we're not really application developers. We can build small applications to kind of prove concepts like the God a Few Minutes or like Edible City. But we're not the developers in Siberia who can really do, you know, hardcore work.
But you have impressed me with your ability, both of you, to sort of create almost anything that you or anyone can imagine that I've seen. I've been very impressed.
I like to say that we're really good at rapid development, that enables our clients to prove concepts, so that they can figure out, whether an idea is practical, whether an interface idea is usable, you know, whether something like our God a Few Minutes app is built on Expression Engine, which isn't really an application, you know, which isn't really meant for application development, but it's so easy to work with that it's perfect for proving a concept.
How committed are you to Expression Engine? Do you see yourselves continuing to go forward with that for the next 5, 10 years?
Definitely for the next 2 or 3 years. It depends on what else comes up. There have been some interesting developments. Like there's a company called Pixel and Tonic, which makes a number of the most popular add-ons for Expression Engine, who have recently launched their own content management system called Craft. I have yet to dig into it. It looks really interesting. But I know that a lot of people are thinking very seriously about the content management process and the tools we use. So I expect in the next couple of years to see some really interesting contenders for, you know, for the next Expression Engine. And by that, I mean content management systems that are both easy to set up and easy to use and as flexible as anyone could possibly want them to be, so that I can't finish that sentence. What I'm trying to say is,
yes,
like WordPress and Expression Engine are often mentioned in the same breath, but I don't think of them as the same at all, because WordPress approaches content from the perspective of a blogging engine. Expression Engine approaches content with no expectations whatsoever. And so I think we're going to see a lot more content management systems that don't come to you with any expectations. They let you do what you need to do, and you don't have to wrangle them in any way. You just tell them what you need them to do.
Or conversely, that perhaps some content management systems that know about adaptive content, mobile content, and like those kind of needs. And I still think there's a great product opportunity. If Karen McGrain had 10 minutes to spare, there's a great product opportunity for some designers and developers to sit down with Karen McGrain.
I mean, that's certainly, this is a problem, you know, all up and down the scale of content management systems, whether you're talking about WordPress, which you have to wrangle to tell it to not be a blog, or you're talking about huge content management systems like Woodwing or some of the other software products that somebody like Random House might use. They're huge and expensive, and they do a lot of things, but you still have to spend a lot of money on consultants to get them to do what you want it to do. So I expect in the next few years that we're going to see that change, and content management systems are going to become kind of more open. Not open in the open source, but open to whatever content you want to give them.
I think this is as good a place as any to break, especially because I think you guys have a meeting coming up very soon. I want to thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
And for your work, the work you do on behalf of all of us, such as HTML5 Reset. And we want to thank Shutterstock, too, for sponsoring our show. Thank you, Shutterstock. I guess the best place for people to find out more about the two of you is to go to monkeydo.biz. That's monkey D-O. Not Monkey Do like Mountain Dew. Monkey Do, D-O. And follow you at Murtaugh on Twitter and at Mike Pick on the Twitter.
That's right.
And Alista Part, of course, where you guys are very involved in the...
Yep.
Yep.
And just so people know, Alista Part is still... We're still actively working on it. So if there's something you want to see, if there are suggestions you have... Please feel free to let any of the three of us know. And we will be opening up an official repo for, you know, the JavaScript and the CSS that are used on the site. And you can harangue us to your heart's content about the logo or any other decisions we've made.
Yep. Very true. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.